Last time we ended up talking about the division Anthophyta, which were the flowering plants. We talked about a number of characteristics of the flowering plants, including the double fertilization that occurs in flowering plants. Today we want to talk a little bit about two classes within the division Anthophyta. If you remember our taxonomic hierarchy, we have kingdom in the case of plants, division, and then the next level on our classification is class. And there are two classes within the division Anthophyta. There's the class monocotyledonae and the class dicotyledonae, sometimes called the monocots and the dicots. Okay? And actually, it's fairly easy in most instances to distinguish the difference between monocots and dicots. Okay? And all flowering plants fit into one of those two classes. The term cotyledon, and of course here you can see that one of them, mono means one, di means two. So it means one cotyledon and two cotyledon is what the class names actually mean. And what a cotyledon is it's the first seed leaf. Okay? You can see that if you dissect a seed. For example, up here in this monocotyledon seed, you can see one initial seed leaf. What we're really talking about here is this. If you were to have a seed growing, it would send out a root, but in addition, we talked about how they need to send up shoots and then get leaves in order so that they can photosynthesize, right? And the monocots only have one seed leaf, okay, when they first germinate. The process of the seed starting to grow is what we call germination. In dicots, of course, they're going to grow a root as well, but when they grow up their shoots, they're actually going to have two first seed leaves or cotyledons. These first seed leaves are what we call the cotyledons. So in monocots, they have one cotyledon or first seed leaf. In dicots, they have two cotyledons or two seed leaves. All right. So that's the first major difference between monocots and dicots. Now, if you were to go out and look at a flowering plant today, you probably couldn't see the seed leaves. Okay, so that's not a characteristic that is very visible, at least when the plant is larger. So there are other characteristics that we can look at. One of the key characteristics is to look at the venation in the leaves. Monocots have what we call parallel leaf venation, and dicots have what we call knitted leaf venation. Typically, monocots have kind of long, narrow leaves. Now, the shape of the leaves is not always a distinguishing characteristic between the two classes, but it generally gives you a fairly good idea of what class the plant lies within. But in monocots, if you look at the veins in the leaves, they're going to be parallel to one another, running down the leaves, something like this. So, what type of a plant has a leaf like that and would be a monocot? Yeah, grass, right? Grasses are monocots. They have those long, narrow leaves with parallel leaf venation. What else? There's some other plants that are actually starting to grow, at least in my flower garden, first thing in spring. Tulips, crocuses, okay, lilies. They all have that same long, narrow leaf with parallel leaf venation. Okay. Now, dicots, on the other hand, are going to have what we call netted leaf venation. Generally, dicot leaves have this same general shape, something like this, fat at the bottom, narrow at the top kind of a thing. But they'll have one main vein coming up the center of the leaf, and they'll have other veins coming off the center of the leaf. Then if you look really close, there are other minor veins coming off of those secondary veins, something like this, and they tend to cross one another, and so it looks like a net. Okay, and so that's where we get the term netted venation. So if you look at this leaf right here, this drawing drawing of a leaf, you can see that the veins kind of overlap and it looks kind of like a net. All right. Now, all dicots generally have that same shape of the leaf, kind of big at the bottom, large at the top. There's lots of different shapes they can have. For example, we looked at an I drew an oak leaf up here the other day, something like this, right? That has basically the same kind of shape as this. Does that make sense? Kind of fat at the bottom, narrow at the top. And there are all sorts of different shapes that leaves can have. But in dicots, they all have that netted leaf venation. Okay? Any questions about that? So monocots have one cotyledon. They have parallel leaf venation. Dicots have two cotyledons and netted leaf venation. Another major difference that you can tell between the plants when you're looking at them, at least when they're flowering, is if you look at the flower parts. In monocots, their flower parts are found in threes or multiples of threes, whereas dicots, their flower parts are found in fours or fives or multiples of fours and fives. And what we're talking about with flower parts is we're talking about petals, stamens, petals, stamens, sometimes sepals, okay? So if you look here at this depiction in the dicot flower, there are five petals in this flower, therefore it must be a dicot. In this one here, you can see the three petals, the three sepals, in this case, there are three sepals and three petals. There should also be three stamen there. So the monocots have flower parts in threes or multiples of threes. Dicots have flower parts in fours or fives or multiples of fours or fives. Now, one thing that's actually quite common in flowers is that you'll have flowers with 12 flower parts. In other words, there will be 12 petals. And when you find a flower like that, it's really hard to tell if it's a monocot or a dicot, other than looking at the leaf venation or some of the other characteristics. Because 12 is a multiple of both 3 and 4, right? Okay. It has 15 flower parts, again, multiple of both 3 and 5. Okay. So typically monocots have 3, 6, 9, 12, something like that, numbers of flower parts. Dicots have 4, 8, 12, or 5, 10, 15. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay, the fourth characteristic that I want you to be aware of is the vascular bundles in the stem. If you were to take and cut a stem of these plants in two, what we find is that in monocots, the vascular bundles in the stems are scattered. Whereas in dicots, the vascular bundles are found in ring-like structures, as you see up here. And so most of the woody flowering plants, the shrubs and so forth, most of them would be dicots, because if you cut their stem, they actually, you can see the rings of vascular tissue. In monocots and something like corn, if you look at the vascular bundles in the stem, they're just kind of scattered all over the place. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay, so in monocots, they have one cotyledon. They have parallel leaf venation, flower parts in threes or multiples of threes, and vascular bundles in the stem that are scattered. Whereas dicots, they have two cotyledons. And you can see the two seed leaves and the seed here. Here and here. They have netted leaf venation, flower parts in fours or fives or multiples of fours and fives, and the vascular bundles in the stem are found in rings. Any questions about that? So actually you can really impress your mom and dad and make them think that whatever money they've given you for college was worthwhile when you go home and you look at your mom's tulip and you say, oh, that flower belongs to the division Anthophyta, class monocotyledonae. And mom and dad will think, man, maybe it really was worth our money to send our kids to school, right? So, any questions about that? The last thing that I want to talk about with plants is just kind of some fun nomenclature or terminology. One of the things that's really common that we get from plants is we get food from plants. We get fruits and vegetables from plants, right? So what's the difference between a fruit and a vegetable?
Taste.
That's fruit.
Fruit what? Can grow above ground, vegetables.
Okay, you said fruit grow above ground, vegetables below ground. Sometimes true. You're close. Somebody said fruits have seeds. Really, the main difference is that fruits are a part or a result of the flowering part of the plant. They typically have seeds. There are some seedless fruits that have been bred nowadays, like you can get seedless watermelons, right? Or seedless grapes. But most fruits have seeds. And what the fruit is it's actually the ovary wall that grows around the seeds, either to protect the seed in some cases, or in some cases to attract animals, birds, so forth, to come and take the fruit and spread the seed some other place, right? Okay. So any part of the plant that is a result of the flowering part of the plant or the reproductive part of the plant is what we would consider to be a fruit. Okay. Any other part of the plant, a root, a rhizome, a stem, a leaf, those would all be considered vegetables. All right. Any questions about that? Yeah.
What about peas?
So would peas be a fruit or a vegetable? They're fruit. They're fruit. Corn is what? Think about it. Does corn have seeds? Yeah, the corn is the seed. The kernels are the seed itself, right? So corn is a fruit, right? Pumpkins, fruit, okay? And then, of course, you know, apples, oranges, we consider all them to be fruits. What about tomatoes? They're a fruit. It's kind of interesting. When I was a kid, I learned this. My dad's a biologist, and he had taught me the difference between fruits and vegetables, and I hate peas, at least when they're cooked. I like fresh peas, but I hate cooked peas. Oh, that's the grossest thing in the world, if you ask me, almost. And I remember my mom cooked peas one day, and she's like, "Eat your vegetables." I said, "I don't see any vegetables on my plate." She whacked me up the side of the head. You know, I was a smart aleck teenager at the time. And she's like, "I don't care what's on your plate, you finish it up," kind of a thing. But really, I didn't have any vegetables on my plate, right? I just had fruits on there. But what would be a vegetable then? Carrot would be a vegetable.
Potato
would be a vegetable.
Radish,
cabbage, lettuce. What about celery? Celery is a vegetable. And here's one that's kind of a cross between a vegetable and a fruit. Cauliflower. Cauliflower, you have what? You're eating the stem, the leaves, and also some of the flowering parts of the plant, right? We still consider cauliflower to be a vegetable, though, because most of it is stems and leaves. Does that make sense to everybody? So it's considered to be a vegetable. So any other part of the plant, other than the flowering part or the results of the flowering part of the plant, would be considered to be a vegetable. Okay? And it's kind of interesting, you can actually classify fruits and vegetables. There's all different ways of using dichotomous keys to classify different types of fruits. There's berries and drupes and dry dehiscent fruits and dry indehiscent fruits and all sorts of things like that. What would an acorn and a nut be, by the way? Fruit. Okay. Any questions about fruits and vegetables? Now, one last bit of terminology that is just kind of fun. Spiny structures on plants, or sticky structures on plants. There are three main types of sticky or pointy type structures on plants that we find. There's what we call thorns, spines, and prickles. Okay. Now, what's the difference between a thorn, a spine, and a prickle? Well, a thorn is a pointed, modified stem. Okay. A spine is a pointed or modified leaf, whereas a prickle is an epidermal structure that usually forms in kind of a cat claw-like nature. It's just a little hook, And if you push sideways on prickles, they'll pop right off generally, okay? So if you think of something like a rose, do roses have thorns then? They don't, they have prickles, right? So, you know the famous rock song, every rose has its thorn? It should really be every rose has its prickle, right? Okay. Because roses have prickles, and some of them actually do have thorns, but not every rose. Right? So prickles are epidermal structures that are kind of cat claw-like, all right? A thorn, then, is actually a modified stem that comes to a point. So I don't know if any of you know what rush and olive trees are, or mesquite. They actually have true thorns on them, okay? If you go out west in the bottom of the valley, there's a plant. Oh, what's the common name? All I can think of now is the scientific name, Sarcobatus vermiculatus. Oh, crying. Greasewood. There's a lot of greasewood out in the bottoms of the valley out here. They actually have thorns as well. Spines are leaves that come to some sort of a point. So something like a holly leaf, like this one shown here, Oregon grape, they have spines on the leaves. But also organisms like cacti. Cacti actually have spines, not thorns. When you look at a cactus, what you're looking at, the big green part of the cactus is actually the stem. And then those spines that come off the cactus are actually the midribs of leaves. Okay? So the leaves don't develop well on cacti. Does that make sense? So a cactus would have a spine. Okay? Any questions about spines, thorns, and prickles? Yeah?
Would raspberries have thorns?
Raspberries have prickles. Yeah. So. Any other questions? Okay, that pretty much finishes up the kingdom plantae. Now, before we move on to the kingdom animalia, I just want to mention that next Tuesday we have a test scheduled, right? Okay. The test will go up through what we just covered, so up through the kingdom plantae. The rest of what we're going to talk about today and on Monday will actually be on the fourth section exam. So we'll kind of split it at the end of the kingdom plantae. So the test next Tuesday will cover taxonomy, the bacteria and archaeobacteria, the protista, fungi, and plantae. All right? Any questions about that? So really, we only have one kingdom of organisms to talk about, left to talk about, and that's the kingdom animalia. The kingdom animalia are, of course, the animals. And if you remember, when we talked about characteristics of the kingdom animalia, we said that they're multicelled eukaryotic organisms. They're heterotrophic, right? They ingest their food, and they are mobile at some point in their life cycle. So those were kind of the characteristics that we used to define the kingdom animalia. The reason why we'll spend a little bit more time on the animals is that animals are the most diverse group of organisms in the world. Okay, there are more species of animals than any other group of organisms. Okay, I think I might have a picture right here. I'll have it later on. But about three-fourths of all species in the world of organisms belong to the kingdom Animalia. Now that doesn't mean that the animals are the most numerous organisms on Earth. In fact, they're far from maybe being the most numerous organisms on Earth. Bacteria, by far and away, are the most numerous organisms on Earth, right? But the diversity of animals is much greater than any other group, okay? So before we start talking about animals, what we want to do is we want to talk about some general characteristics of animals and how we can look at animals and determine whether they're primitive from an evolutionary standpoint or have more advanced characteristics from an evolutionary standpoint. Okay. So first of all, we're going to introduce some new terminology. One of the first characteristics that we look at when we look at an animal is what type of symmetry that they have. Symmetry, of course, is when you cut something down the middle, is there a mirror image? Okay. So are things symmetrical on either side of the body? There are actually three types of symmetry. Maybe you could say just two types of symmetry. The first type of symmetry that's not up on the picture here, and is really no symmetry at all, is what we call asymmetrical body plan. Asymmetry means, the prefix a means not, so there are some animals that have no symmetry at all. There's actually very few of them. But there is one group of animals that are asymmetrical. Okay? Most animals are either radially symmetric or bilaterally symmetric. A radially symmetrical animal, such as this jellyfish here, from basically what you can do with a radially symmetrical animal is there are infinite numbers of planes in which you can cut the animal and still have a mirror image. In other words, you could cut it here, like it shows on these lines here, and still have a mirror image. You could actually cut the organism here and still have a mirror image. Cut it here. So basically, you can cut the organism through at any point. You can cut the organism in half and still have a mirror image of that organism. Okay. Are there any questions about that? Now, from an evolutionary perspective, radially symmetrical organisms are less advanced than bilaterally symmetrical organisms. A bilaterally symmetrical organism, then, is an organism that has only one plane in which you can cut that organism and still have a mirror image. So if you look at this bird here, or at the snake in the picture, there's only one place that you can cut those organisms and still have a mirror image. We are bilaterally symmetric. If you think about it, the only place that you could cut a human being and still have a mirror image would be where? Right down the middle of the body, right? Okay. You couldn't cut us this way and have a mirror image, right? Okay. There's only one plane in which you can cut the organism and still have a mirror image. Now we said that the bilaterally symmetrical organisms are a little bit more advanced from an evolutionary perspective. And one of the things that makes them more advanced is that typically if animals are bilaterally symmetric, they have something that we call cephalization. And basically what cephalization is it's a head structure, okay? So if you notice the bird there, the snake, we all have heads, okay? Or what we would call a cephalic region. So our head, the scientific term for that is a cephalic region, right? Now, the reason why this is an evolutionary advancement is typically cephalic regions have lots of sensory structures associated with them. If you think about our head, we have pretty much every sense in our body, or that is available in our body, we have in our cephalic region, right? It's where we smell, it's where we see, it's where we hear, it's where we taste. We can even touch, have a sense of touch on our head, right? Okay. Now the reason why this is an evolutionary advancement is because organisms that have cephalic regions, they can either face their environment or they can turn around and run away from their environment. Okay, and so their defensive mechanisms can be either to run away or to face their environment. And if they have defensive mechanisms, they're going to be focused in that cephalic region or typically on the anterior part of the body, right? Or sometimes you'll have them on the posterior part of the body, but opposite the cephalic region. So there's a distinct part of the body that's able to deal with its environment. Whereas radially symmetrical organisms, if you think about a jellyfish, they really don't have any one part of the body that can actually deal with their environment. They have to have defensive mechanisms around the entire body so that they can defend themselves, catch food, all of those types of things that go into dealing with one's environment. There's not really one part of the body that's specialized to function with their environment. Does that make sense to everybody? So in bilaterally symmetrical organisms, they have one part of their body that's used to deal with their environment. Feeding, danger, those types of things. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay, bilaterally symmetric organisms, not only do they have cephalic regions, but they're typically more advanced in other ways. And when we talk about radially symmetric and bilaterally symmetric organisms, we can actually use some terms to talk about directions in the organism. And those terms are fairly standardized. For example, in radially symmetrical organisms, there's only two directions that we talk about. There's what we call the oral end of the organism and the aboral end of the organism. The oral end is where we would find the mouth. The aboral end is the end opposite the mouth. Okay. So for example, in this jellyfish, we're looking up underneath the bottom of the jellyfish. If it were floating out in the water and moving a little bit, kind of like my hand is here, where would the oral end be? It would actually be down here, and the aboral end would be up here. Does that make sense? So those are the only two directional terms. Now if you have something like a coral that's attached to a substrate, it sits up like kind of like this, like my hand's doing here, the oral end would be where? Up here, right? And the aboral end would be down here. So it depends on the direction that the organism is in, but the oral end is always the end that has the mouth closest to it. The aboral end is the end opposite the mouth in a radially symmetrical organism. Okay? Any questions? In bilaterally symmetrical organisms, there are actually a number of different directions that we can distinguish in a bilaterally symmetrical organism. This is a picture of a rabbit, but before we really talk about directions, let me mention one important thing as we talk about directions in bilaterally symmetrical organisms. When we're talking about directions in a bilaterally symmetrical organism, we need to have some rules, and the rule is this: the organism must be on all of its appendages or in its normal crawling position before we start talking about directions. Okay? So if it's something like a rabbit, when we're talking about directions, it needs to be on all of its appendages or on all of its legs. If we're talking about a human, what position would we need to be in? We'd actually need to have our hands on the floor, right, and our feet on the floor before we talk about direction. Does that make sense to everybody? Now a snake doesn't have legs, it doesn't have appendages. So what position would a snake need to be in? It needs to be in its normal crawling position, okay? And if you look at a snake or a worm, you can distinctly tell the difference between the bottom of the worm and the top of the worm, right? Where its normal crawling position is. They actually have different colorations, different characteristics. So when we're talking about direction in bilaterally symmetrical organisms, the organism needs to be on all of its appendages or in its normal crawling position, okay? Now there are four main terms that are used to describe direction in bilaterally symmetrical organisms, and then some other kind of, accessory terms. The first two terms are anterior and posterior. So the term anterior is the part of the organism that is closest, or the direction towards the cephalic region of the organism. Posterior is the opposite of anterior, so it's the end opposite the cephalic region. Okay. So in this rabbit, the anterior end is towards the head, posterior end's towards the rear end there. Okay. What about humans? Where's our anterior end? Which direction? The way I'm standing here, it would be what? Straight up, right? Okay. But I have to be in my normal, on all of my appendages. So where's posterior? It'd be your rear end, right? It's not your feet, because you have to be on all of your appendages. Does that make sense? Okay. So anterior and posterior. And then the other two terms are dorsal and ventral. Dorsal is the part of the organism that is closest to the sky. This is the way I remember it most easily. It's the part that's closest to the sky when the organism's on all of its appendages or in its normal crawling position. Ventral is the part that's closest to the ground when it's in that same position. Okay? So the dorsal part of the rabbit would be its back. The ventral part is what we would normally call its belly. Okay? Any questions about that? What about in humans? Where's our dorsal side? It would be our back, right? And the ventral side would be what? Stomach. Okay. because we have to be on all of our appendages. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. Now, these directional terms, we're not going to get into this a whole lot in general biology, but if you take a class like anatomy, or if you take a more advanced biology class where you're dissecting, one of the things about these terms is these terms are all relative. And what that means is that you can use these terms to describe where a structure is within the body. Okay? For example, my heart is dorsal to my chest, ventral to my backbone. Does that make sense? So it's further or closer to the sky in my normal crawling position than my what? Than my chest. I said it's dorsal to my chest. Okay? It's ventral to my backbone. Is that true? It's closer to the ground than my backbone. Okay? It's anterior to my stomach, which means it's closer to the head than my stomach, and it's posterior to my throat. Does that make sense? See, that's just kind of an example. You can use these terms, relatively speaking, to describe where a structure is within the body. Right? Any questions about that? Two other terms that I just want to introduce to you is proximal and distal. Proximal and distal, these terms only apply when an animal has an appendage, such as a leg or an arm. And the term proximal and distal, proximal means closer to the point of attachment than, and distal means further away from the point of attachment than. Now, again, these terms are relative. Now, the reason why we don't use the term closer to or farther away is because of this. If you look up here, is my hand closer to my body than my elbow? Depends on which hand you're looking at, right? Okay. So what we have to use is we have to use the point of attachment, where that appendage hooks to my body. Does that make sense to everybody? So you could actually use these terms to describe, for example, where the elbow is. My elbow is distal to my shoulder and it's proximal to my wrist. Okay. In other words, it's farther away from the point of attachment than my shoulder, but it's closer to the point of attachment than my wrist. Does that make sense to everybody? So those are some terms that can be used relatively. Right? Any questions about that? Okay, so now that we know a little bit about directional terms in animals, some other terms that can be very important is in animals is looking at how many tissue layers are found within an animal. In some animals, they have no tissue at all. Remember back earlier in the semester, we talked about animal tissues. We said that there can be as many as 4 different animal tissues. We said that there's epidermis. There is epidermis, muscle tissue, nervous tissue, and connective tissue. Okay, remember that? So those are the 4 main types of tissue that we can find in animals. Some animals have no tissue at all, and so what we're saying is that their cells don't function as a single unit. So there are some animals without tissue at all, and there's actually only one group of them that have no tissue organization. There's one group of animals that we call diploblastic. Diploblastic animals have 2 tissue layers. They have ectoderm and endoderm during development. Most animals are what we call triploblastic when they first start to develop. And that means at the very beginning they actually have 3 tissue layers which can develop into the 4 different types of tissue that we just mentioned. The triploblastic animals have an ectoderm, an endoderm, and then a mesoderm. Now, in these organisms, the ectoderm usually forms the covering of the skin, okay, or the covering of the organism, such as the skin. The endoderm usually forms the gut, and the mesoderm in triploblastic animals is going to form everything else in between. Okay? So diploblastic animals are considered to be more primitive from an evolutionary perspective. There's only going to be one group of animals that we're going to talk about that has diploblastic tissue level organization. Most animals are triploblastic. Okay, so Most animals have three tissue layers, or three tissue layers during development. Okay. Now the reason why I'm kind of going through the animals this way is you could actually be kind of constructing a dichotomous key once we start talking about the phyla within the kingdom Animalia. The first characteristic you could use is, do they have tissue layers or no tissue layers? Or you could use symmetry, right? And the second characteristic you could use is, are they, if they have tissue layers during development, are they diploblastic or are they triploblastic? Okay? And most animals are triploblastic. In fact, probably if I were to have you list 100 different animals, most of you, all 100 of them would be triploblastic animals. Okay? Unless you listed something like a jellyfish or a coral, they're all triploblastic pretty much. Okay. Now, within triploblastic animals, there are three different types of body plans that we can find within triploblastic organisms. There's what we call the acoelomate body plan, the pseudocoelomate, and the coelomate body plan. So some animals, A means what? Not or no, so they have no coelom, whatever a coelom is, right? We have some organisms that have a pseudocoelom. What does pseudo mean? Fake or false coelom. And we have some animals that have a coelom. Now what a coelom is it's a body cavity. And this picture here kind of shows the difference between coelomate, pseudocoelomate, and acoelomate body plan. Now most of the animals that you're familiar with are actually coelomate. Okay? The vast majority of animals are actually coelomate, or have a body cavity. When you think of an animal, you probably think of animals with body cavities because, again, most animals do have them. Now, let me just kind of describe what a body cavity is. As development occurs in these organisms, what a body cavity is, it's a cavity inside of the body that allows organs and organ systems to function independently of the body itself. Now, we have a coelom, okay, or we have the coelom or a body cavity. If you were to cut one of us open, what would you find? You could actually dish all of our guts and heart and lungs and everything else out of our body, right? And there'd be this big old cavity in there, right? If any of you have ever slaughtered an animal or been hunting and gutted an animal, the animals you hunt are all coelomate. And you can just pull all the guts and heart and everything else out, and there's this big old cavity inside of the body, right? Okay, that's the coelom, okay, that big old body cavity. Now, the advantages of having the body cavity, and the coelomate organisms are the most advanced from an evolutionary perspective, is that you can have independently functioning organ systems. For example, your heart. Do you guys think about causing your heart to beat? No, it just beats on its own, right? And why can it beat on its own? Well, it's because there's space around the heart. There's nothing that is so close to the heart that it causes the heart to stop beating, right? So the heart's kind of sitting out in space almost by itself, and the heart can beat independently of any other organ system in your body, correct? Same thing is true with your digestive system. When you swallow food, do you think about pushing the food out through the other end and digesting it? What do you do if you eat something like, for me it's like bell peppers or something, right? And there's indigestion. But most of the time you don't think about those types of things until they come out the other end, right? All the waste material. So what happens is you swallow the food, and through peristaltic action, your digestive system pushes that food down your esophagus and into your stomach, and then from your stomach to your small intestine, and then from your small intestine to your large intestine. And then again, you think about it, hopefully you think about it when it comes out the other end, right? Okay. And so basically that digestive system, the reason why it can function independently is because, again, it's sitting out in space. It's all by itself. Okay. Now let me contrast the coelomate organisms with the acoelomate organisms, those without a body cavity, up there on the top. In organisms that do not have a body cavity at all, what happens is their gut is completely surrounded by other tissue, by what we call mesodermal-derived tissue. And that mesodermally-derived tissue is completely surrounded by epidermally-derived tissue. So, for example, if you would imagine this magic marker being the gut of an acelomate organism, okay? Actually, let's imagine it being the gut of a coelomate organism, first of all, one with a body cavity. If you think of our body, we have this gut, and it's kind of sitting out in space. And so food can go through the gut. We don't really have to worry about it, right, until it comes out the other end. In the acelomate organism, what happens is the mesodermally derived tissue is directly around the gut, and then you have epidermis directly around the mesoderm. Okay, kind of like my hand around this marker. Therefore, when an animal that is acelomate eats, can their gut just push the food through the gut by itself? It can't, because everything's connected. So what these animals would have to do is they would actually have to move their body in order to push the food through the gut. Does that make sense? Okay. So acelomate organisms have no independently functioning organ systems. So you're not going to find something like a heart, you're not going to find something like a lung, you're not going to find something like a kidney in these organisms, okay? Because there's no play, everything's kind of connected to everything else. So nothing functions independently of the body itself. So when these organisms eat, they actually have to move their body to push their food through their digestive system, okay? What's that?
Isn't that kind of what snakes do?
Actually, snakes don't. They actually are coelomate. They actually have a body cavity. They don't have to think about things once they eat it. Yeah, they get really fat, but their digestive system actually pushes it through. Okay. An example of an organism that is acoelomate would be something like a fluke or a tapeworm. There are not very many acelomate organisms.
Where would a starfish be?
Starfish are actually coelomate. They have a body cavity. If you open them up, you can take the skin off, and there's a little cavity inside there. It's not very big. Worms, for example, you know what you normally would think of as a worm, a nightcrawler. They actually have a body cavity. If you open them up, they actually have independently functioning organ systems within a cavity. Okay. Now, a pseudocoelomate organism is a little bit different. They actually have one independently functioning organ system, and that's the digestive system. However, they don't have any other independently functioning organ systems. What happens in pseudocoelomate organisms is the mesoderm actually, In the coelomate organism, most of the organ systems are a result of endodermal and inner mesodermal formation. So our lungs and our heart form from the inside mesoderm or the endoderm, okay? And in a pseudocoelomate organism, what they have is they have a gut, and it's completely surrounded by mesodermal tissue, kind of like what we talked about with the acoelomate organisms. But then there's a break in that mesoderm, and so there's kind of a hole in the mesoderm. You could think of it like that. So the gut can actually function independently of the rest of the body, but they won't have things like a heart or any other organ systems in their body. Okay, and again, there are actually very few pseudocoelomate organisms. Most of the organisms are coelomate. An example of a pseudocoelomate organism would be something that we would call a roundworm, something like a nematode. And you may not even know what they are now, but we'll actually talk about them a little bit later on. Okay.
A snake.
Now, snakes are actually coelomate. Yeah, if you open up a snake, they've got lungs and guts and everything else in there. There's a big old cavity. You can actually pull the inside out. Okay. Any other questions about acoelomate, pseudocoelomate, or coelomate? Now, since most of the animals are coelomate, we're actually going to talk about some characteristics that separate out some of the coelomate organisms. Okay. So you can kind of think of this as kind of a dichotomous key. In triploblastic organisms, we can talk about acoelomate, pseudocoelomate, and coelomate organisms. Okay, does that make sense? In coelomate organisms, there are two different types of development that occur within these coelomate organisms. There's what we call the protostome, protostomate development, and deuterostomate development. Okay, so protostomate and deuterostomate development in within the coelomate organisms. Okay. Now there are quite a few differences between protostomate and deuterostomate organisms, and I'm only going to talk about a couple of differences. Okay. That's probably good enough for a general biology class. But one of the major differences is the way in which the gut forms in protostomate versus deuterostomate animals. On the left-hand side, we have how the gut forms in the protostomate, on the right-hand side, deuterostomate. The first thing that forms in the gut, or the first opening of the gut, is what we call the blastophore. It's not real critical that you remember that term. Okay? But here's the major difference. In protostomate animals, the first opening becomes the mouth. So basically, the gut forms from the mouth to the anus. In deuterostomate animals, the gut form, that first opening becomes the anus. So the gut forms from the anus to the mouth. Does that make sense? So it's just an opposite way of forming the gut. Now, the most advanced type of development is deuterostomate development. And the reason why we say it's the most advanced is because that's the type of development we have. And we think we're the most advanced organisms, so therefore it must be the most advanced, right? Okay. So in deuterostomate animals, we are deuterostomates. You can think of it this way. Your anus is older than your mouth because your anus formed before your mouth. In a protostomate animal, something like an insect, their mouth is actually older than their anus because their gut forms from their mouth to their anus. Okay. Any questions about that? Now, another major difference between protostomate and deuterostomate animals is that protostomate animals have what we call indeterminate cleavage. Protostomate animals have determinate cleavage, and deuterostomate animals have indeterminate cleavage. What we're talking about here is when we start out with a single-celled animal, what's going to happen to that single cell that's been that's a result of sperm and ova fusing? It's going to go through mitosis, right? And then what we're going to get is we're going to get a two-celled animal. Both of those cells go through mitosis, and then we get a four-celled animal, right? All four of those cells go through mitosis, we get an eight-celled animal. All those eight cells go through mitosis, we get a 16-celled animal. Does that make sense? Okay. So that's where we're talking about determinate versus indeterminate cleavage. Very early on in development, actually about the four-cell stage in protostomate animals, these cells have already been determined as to what they're going to become in the adult. In deuterostomates, these cells don't determine themselves until at least the 64-cell stage and sometimes later. Okay? Now, what are the implications of that? Let me give you an example. If you were to take a grasshopper in the four-cell stage of development, okay, and you were to separate out each of those cells and put them in a petri dish and get them to grow, each of those cells have already been determined as to what they're going to become. So what you would end up with is you would end up with four petri dishes with different parts of the grasshopper. One petri dish might have a head and a front leg. Another petri dish might grow a hind leg and an abdomen. Okay. The other petri dish might grow one of the middle pairs of legs and part of the thorax. Okay. So each of those petri dishes would have a different part of the organism, because very early on in development, as early as the four-cell stage, those cells are already determined as to what they're going to become in the adult animal. Okay, any questions about that? Now, in deuterostomate animals, they have indeterminate cleavage. What that means is up until about the 64-cell stage, or maybe even later, if we were to do the same thing with a human, if we were to take it at the four-cell stage, a human embryo at the four-cell stage, and separate out those four cells and implant all four of those cells into the uterine wall, would we end up with just parts of a baby? No, you would end up with four complete babies, right? Okay. And that's because those cells don't determine themselves until later on. And so remember when we talked about identical twins? We said what identical twins were is they were a result of a single fertilization, and then the egg mass, these cells, actually divide, and both of those egg masses implant themselves into the uterine wall, and so those individuals are genetically identical. Remember that? Okay. And so in determinate cleavage, with determinate cleavage, such as in the protostomate animals, the cells are determined as to what they're going to become very early on in development. In deuterostomate animals, determination of those cells does not occur until later on in development. One last thing before you go. Think about this. Have all of you heard of stem cell research before? What are they trying to do there? Yeah, they're actually trying. You've heard all the talk about using of embryological cells, right, for stem cell treatment. What happens, what they call these cells that haven't been determined yet, is we sometimes call them stem cells. So the idea behind stem cell research is if we can take this cell here that hasn't been determined, and we can cause it to become determined to be a pancreatic cell, for example. If we could take those cells and put them into an adult pancreas, maybe we could get that pancreas to grow a new part of the pancreas that was actually healthy. Now, the reason why I use pancreas is because your pancreas is what secretes insulin. So diabetics have pancreas essentially that isn't functioning properly, right? But if you could take stem cells and cause them to become determined to become pancreatic cells, you might be able to take those stem cells and insert them into an existing pancreas and get them to grow, that pancreas to grow new pancreatic cells, which may allow that individual to not be a diabetic anymore. Does that make sense? Okay. So when they talk about stem cells, they're really talking about these cells that haven't been determined yet. Alright? So just one last thing before you go. Just kind of keep this in mind. We have no tissue layer, no tissue development. Some animals have no tissue layers. Other animals are diploblastic. Other animals are triploblastic. In those that are triploblastic, we can say that they are either acoelomate, pseudocoelomate, or coelomate. We said that most animals are coelomate. And with those animals that are coelomate, then we can divide them out further into those that have protostomate development and those that have deuterostomate development. Okay? Any questions? All right, we'll see you on Monday.